Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Brian.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am doing spectacular, like Spider-Man, the Spectacular Spider-Man. Did you know JMS wrote for Spider-Man?
The Spectacular?
There's such thing. There's the Amazing and there's the Spectacular Spider-Man. Maybe it's time for us to become a spider podcast where we only talk about Spider-Man properties.
But I do think we should add that to the list of potential series for There Be Movies 2.
Oh, yes, our Patreon exclusive content.
Exclusive. I think we should do all of the Spider-Man movies.
All of them? Even some of those wacky ones? All right, Rachel's locked it in.
I think that should be on the list because I've had an awful enough time
with the Alien franchise.
With all of the other franchises, so...
Oh, come on, you love the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, but it still has some stinkers.
We've got the Babylon 5 movies to look forward to at least, huh? Those are movies that we've got coming up in a bit, but we are actually watching through the series right now.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end of season 4.
Yes, and we are rewatching it, revisiting it, and reviewing every single episode.
Spoilers,
yeah, every single episode, one at a time. And those movies will be coming up soon. We've got In the Beginning coming up in a little bit. But today we are here to talk about a very monumental episode of Season 4 here on Yum Yum Podcast. Yum Yum 5 is where we are actually talking about Babylon 5. And Yum Yum was a moment from Star Trek Discovery, a series near and dear to our hearts. And it's a moment where a character randomly said Yum Yum out of nowhere. And it was such a bizarre moment of television that it never left our minds, our hearts, our souls. And so we brought it
forever
over.
Forever stained us and the universe.
That's exactly right. And so we brought it with us to this podcast to help stain you, the listeners, or as we like to call you, yumlings, to stain you with the knowledge that a woman licked her lips sexily, threw her hair back, and breathily said, "Yum, yum," in reply to a normal question. A question normal in the context of a television show of like, "Hey, do you want to help me kill the antagonist of the season?" And the answer should be yes or no, or maybe.
Yum, yum.
No, not like that. Come on. That was far more aggressive.
No, I'm saying definitively.
It was yum, yum.
It was yum, yum. They made a choice. They stuck with it. They paid somebody to say it. They paid somebody to edit it.
And we paid the price. As viewers, we paid the price when that moment came on our television
screens. It stole
screens.
Something from us. It stole something from us.
But it did not steal the Babylon 5 DVD descriptions.
No.
Episode 20, Endgame.
What's JMS got to say about this episode?
Well, JMS wrote for the DVD description this: first Mars, then Earth. Sheridan and his forces, including telepaths modified to become rogue agents inside the enemy CPUs, begin a methodical plan of attack against Clark and his Earth Force fighters.
You've been given a list of our ships that have defected to their sides, and their friend or foe systems have been adjusted accordingly. If a ship is on that list, you are authorized to open fire on that ship or any support vessel, alien or human. You are to forget that these people were once friends, associates, and fellow officers. They are targets to be destroyed. Nothing more, nothing less.
Here we are. The end of a very long arc that's been building since the very beginning of Babylon 5. The Earth Civil War. The brewing tensions and the growing fascism of Earth has been really present since you start the show. And so what does one do to wrap that up? And Endgame is the answer to that. But before we get into our histories and relationship with this particular episode, many people are in this one. guest stars, our main cast of characters, and heck, even President Clark himself turned up for this one, a character that is often talked about but rarely seen. And I want to know, who in your opinion could have said yum yum? Who had YYE, yum yum energy? In your expert opinion, Rachel, as somebody with a master's degree in yum yum, what's your opinion?
I'm working on the doctorate, but it's very hard to find supervisors. For this particular episode, I want to give an honorable mention to the senator who reports Clark's death.
Of course.
Because that would be a real echo of the original moment of Yum Yum in Discovery.
Of course.
So I feel like it's worth mentioning.
That actress has been in a million things, and she's always sexy in them, by the way. She was in Star Trek a lot, as many guest star appearances.
I look at her and go, she's evil.
Of course, and that's a part of this. It's called smoldering. That's the particular brand of sexy. She was in the TNG episode called The Face of the Enemy, where Deanna Troi has to be made up as a Romulan and is implanted in the group, and this woman played the sexy Romulan lady. You also may remember her from Voyager in Janeway's holodeck saga novel about being a governess. And this woman was, I think, like the evil nanny character. She was in there a bunch. And
it would have been the maid.
Yeah, she was the evil maid
Janeway
or something.
She was the governess.
And then Quantum Leap. The episodes with the evil leapers.
Yes.
She was the evil hologram.
Yes.
So awesome to see her here. I didn't realize that until I just wanted to look her up because I heard that voice, that particular sexy British accent, and I said, I know that voice from something.
Okay.
And I think, in my opinion, she had YYE. You said that's a contender, but for me, she was one I wrote in my notes. My second choice was Left Court. He just had that swagger of a man from 1947 who would have said yum yum after giving Jerry a good hit with his fist.
See, my contender that I was going to put forth was the guy that basically got demoted for Left Court.
The British captain?
Yeah, the British captain who's just like, if I may, sir.
If I may, can we nominate and actually award this to all of the British cast members in this singular episode? There's three that I'm aware of, and that's more than we usually ever get. There's Marcus, there's that senator lady, and there's that captain. Let's give it to the Brits. When's their next opportunity to ever get such a prodigious award?
Marcus won't be with us much longer. So.
This is his last time to get it.
Yep.
History in relationship with Endgame. I will be real honest with the people out there. Endgame has always been an episode to me that I look at with a fondness and appreciation for, but it's not one that I overall am in love with. For the conclusion to something that's been building for so long, I find it satisfactory, but it's not the one that I...
It had some heavy lifting.
It had a lot of things to do. And it's one of those things where with a conflict that is so deeply personal to our heroes, this is their home they're fighting for. These are the people that they've served with. They're all on supposedly on the same side, but everything has become so dark in these times. It wraps up in such a jolly way that I always find to be very hard to grasp at, considering the serious tone.
James does love the tonal contrast.
He does love the tonal contrast, and I've always thought it was a good episode, but even within the Earth Civil War fights that we've had, I don't think that this one leaves as much of a mark to me as, say, No Surrender, No Retreat. The technicals of it are all fine. The acting is all good. The twists and turns and how they take back things works. But none of it has ever blown me away. The things that I'm left with thinking about this is not the defeat of Earth itself, all of the obstacles that Sheridan had to go through to get there, but rather those personal moments on the outside. The conversations about Ivanova, hearing about Marcus leaving and the reasoning as to why, and of course, even the ISN reporter coming back. It's more about those quiet, small, emotional beats rather than the bits that the show clearly wants me to be far more engaged by, the big, swelling beats of the story, such as when the Agamemnon flies through the debris and the explosion of that defense system, and the music swells and everyone's cheering and happy. I always look at the moments like that in this episode with a mild smile. Just, yeah, sure, that's nice. What about you, Endgame?
I always, like, for a long time, I forgot that this wasn't the finale, because the actual finale is so odd and so out of left field for the show that I always think of this as being the end of the series, and then the next one is kind of tacked on in a weird way. So I think I have this of like, oh yeah, that's when everything wraps up. Because it is. But it is very different than the way that that happens in prestige shows now, where it is like the build up is to the second or third last episode, and then the last two are just setting up for the next season.
Or it is a reflection, a quiet contemplation on what we just watched.
Yep.
Which you could argue the next two episodes are.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that one is kind of the way that I often think about this episode. Because there's nothing really wrong with it. But it is, like, I feel like it's just so heavy with plot, and it doesn't have enough time to let anything breathe. So it just becomes very serviceable.
Would you say that that's season four, though? Because I have noticed in our discussions, those phrases that you've used to describe the episode has been recurring a lot.
It's not a issue with this episode that is distinct from the rest of the season, because they were so pushed for time. They were trying to get so much done in one season and trying to make it work.
Yeah.
And yeah, episodes like this are going to happen where it is just sort of a workhorse episode in terms of its structure. But because JMS has done so much work with the characters, it elevates it. It doesn't make it stick, though, or stick out, because it is so boom, boom, boom. Just, we got to keep on rolling through.
So boom today.
Boomed. Boom today.
Boom. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom. Boom.
Let's talk about Ivanova and Marcus. Their side of the story is fairly self-contained. It does bleed over into Sheridan's war against Earth and saving of the day.
Near the blubbermouth.
That is nefarious, Lanier.
Just because he would do it for Delenn.
I felt a lot during this. I've enjoyed Marcus on our watch and our discussions, and knowing the fate of the character, of course, I ignore the short story as any real Babylon 5 fan would, but knowing how this all goes, it's really upsetting because he has really solidified as a character. We got past those rough beginnings of him being so quippy to the point of grinding one's teeth, to seeing him be a good friend to many of these people that we've loved since the beginning. He was great at grounding all of these characters and giving them something to bounce off of, whilst also giving something in return as a person. Jason Carter gives a really sublime performance in this episode. It's asking him to play into the side of Marcus that we mainly get glimpses of rather than be the extent of, which is the quiet, brooding sadness. Many scenes here are just of him silently looking and contemplating and reflecting.
The pain that he's hiding.
And processing and having to confront. I really like this, even though it's sad. I like sad things in my show, and I like that things don't always get a happy ending. And Marcus was a character who, from the beginning, was somebody who was looking for a reason to die, and he found one. And it's really upsetting, of course, but it's poetic and it lines up and it makes sense. There's many moments here of him just exclaiming how unfair this is, exclaiming and just saying out loud that this isn't right, and if other characters in this show can defeat death, then why can't Ivanova? And why can't Marcus find a way to do that? And it's a great piece of writing on JMS's part to point out that this is a series where he, as a creator, has found ways to subvert death. And that's always tricky to add into your show. If you can defeat death, if you can resurrect characters, what are the stakes? What are the tensions in it? Does anything matter? I remember back in the day, for instance, when Loki in the MCU died, and then he came back, and then he died, and then he came back, and then he died. It really just lent credence to, does anything matter if one of the central villains never dies and always comes back, and they play it for those emotional beats of the death being real, then to just twist it around again and say, nah, he's back. And Doctor Who has that problem a lot too. I appreciate that this is a story where we do that, where at the end he uses this healing device to bring our great Ivanova character back into the fold, but it has the cost of his life and they're not able to do anything about it. Sorry, no. That short story, I haven't read it, so
I have.
I'm saying I haven't read it in a good way.
Oh, I thought wanted to invite that discussion.
You can leap into it. You are the reader out of the two of us. It is a story I know the synopsis of and I reject it. I've seen it at the synopsis and you've told me about it and I just say no thank you, nope.
Okay, well, fine then, we won't talk about it. It doesn't exist, bye bye.
Oh, you liked it, didn't you?
I did.
Where Marcus secretly is alive and cryo-frozen, he wakes up and makes a weird creepy clone of Ivanova.
Because she wasn't fully dead, so he didn't give all of his life force to save her, was just on the brink of death. And they have all of these empty cryo tubes on Babylon 5 because they used a bunch of the popsicles.
They did use the popsicles in this episode.
Like, it's minute. It's minute. I like, it's weirder that it's not the real Ivanova to me. Like, I accept
Yes.
The Marcus stuff more than I accept the fake Ivanova stuff.
Yes, and does the fake Ivanova have the ability of consent?
Yeah, like...
Whatever, man.
When they basically programmed her for Marcus?
Yikes.
Like, they kind of pushed that agenda on her a bit.
So you're still liking it?
It's not perfect, okay? But I have to admit something. I wasn't as in love with them this time.
What are you saying? I have audio evidence of you saying that you're really in love with these two and their relationship lack of relationship.
I am.
And the flirting and the potential and unrequited love.
Yes, and I love all of that. But I didn't cry this time. Mm. Almost every other single time I have cried. I've bawled my eyes out when you get the shot of him and he says, I love you. And like I welled up, but I didn't cry.
Wow.
And I just felt that the younglings deserved to know that truth. That this time it didn't bring that out fully. I am still devastated. I am even angry when I think of Marcus's replacement figure of the next long-haired
British man. Pretty British boy. Who was designed to be for Ivanova if she stayed. Yikes again.
Yep.
Big yikes.
So, but like, I was just like, it was really sweet this time more than heartwarming and heart-wrenching of like,
he tried his best.
Like, a little pumpy limping.
A little pumpy.
Pumpy.
A little puppy who's
little
a pumpkin.
Puppy. In a pumpkin suit.
In a little pumpkin suit. That's Marcus. He's a little puppy in a pumpkin suit. Artists, draw that for us, please. And bring it in before the episode finishes, okay? One of the things I wanted to know from you was he is saddled with Linnea for this episode.
That's a loaded word, Ryan.
Because Linnea is being hostile in opposition. He isn't beating around the bush. Linnea just straight up says she's dead. She's just going to be dead. You have to accept it, Marcus. And I wanted to know your opinions on pairing these two together to have these conversations, because Linnea and Marcus have been paired up many times before.
Yes, but it feels like a massive downgrade after having Marcus and Franklin. It doesn't feel the same. You know how good Marcus can be when paired with the right character? And Linnea is not the right character to be paired with Marcus. Like, it's a very functional decision, because who's going to be on the ship with Marcus? Linnea makes sense. Who would incidentally lead Marcus to the alien machine? Linnea.
Because he knows about it.
Delenn sidestepped it, but tipped Marcus off that little bit. But Linnea gave him something concrete enough to go search.
I actually think it makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Because not just of practicality, I completely agree. You wonder what this would be like if it was Franklin. Because Franklin also cares about Ivanova more. And if he said, and he's also a doctor, if he said, hey, Ivanova is going to die, this is something you have to accept, you can see it being very devastating on that person-to-person level. Linnea makes a lot of sense and I think works very well and dramatically speaking, is very rich to see him, through gritted teeth, deny this, because Marcus is in a similar situation to Linnea, in which they are in love with somebody they cannot have. And Marcus is at the precipice of it, right? Where Ivanova will be gone. She will be lost. And what a tragedy that would be on many, many levels, but in this one particularly, where you will definitely not be able to have her now. And I look at Linnea in these conversations and see that coldness that he does have, or that curt way of interjecting his points of view, as almost a tad amount of jealousy on the fact that Marcus can actively pursue a person and not feel weird about it, while Linnea, he's Mr. My love is pure and I keep it to myself and I repress it and I'm a good boy, and if I just keep being a good little boy and kneeling at the feet of the woman I love, maybe it will come back onto me. While Marcus is going to give his own life for the person he loves.
Since Franklin's planet side, I put a call into Dr. Hobbs. In all this time, they must have come up with something to help deal with near-fatal conditions.
No.
That was fast. Hit by divine revelation, were we? Don't you even want to check? Don't you care?
Of course I care. But there is nothing usable on Babylon 5.
What do you mean, nothing usable?
It is another reason why these characters are paired together. Because it makes sense on multiple levels for Linnea to peel back the curtain a little bit, enough to let Marcus see through and decide whether he wants to or not go through that. But I also dislike it because it reminds me of the stuff that they do with Linnea.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that.
Oh, I'm sorry. It exists, Rachel. It does exist. Just like Franklin's medical logs that goes through all of the weird encounters with people with certain circumstances that could lead to death. I like that we got a follow-up.
Confirmation that the lounge singer is dead, too.
You took it from me. I like that we got that confirmed. It was, even though Walkabout is an episode that it's probably best not to refer to it again, the fact that it is referred to lends credence to it existing. I'm much more of a fan of things mattering more than, oh, that sucked, let's move on, type storytelling. That's a big difference between you and I. We were actually debating about this when talking over the first season of The Expanse over on our Patreon, where there's a character in that season who has yet to reappear after the first season, and I argue that I need them to reappear to matter, and it's a character we don't like, and you just said if they never reference him again or have him again, it's good. But the touch on Walkabout was cute in that way of like, oh, look, they're actually referencing. That's nice. But I also like seeing these logs and how they cycle back in time, and you get to see Franklin with the different uniforms and the different attitudes in each one of them. It was nice to see it winding back time on his character. Now, the healing device has been here since season one. They already used it to save Garibaldi. And I think for a good portion of people out there, us included, it was a shock and a bit of a surprise that they brought back the healing device, because
it was used that one time. So why would it come back again?
That's what devastates me, is JMS brings this thing in from previous seasons. He brings it back in. And we already know what it does. We already know what it's capable of. And when he says, oh yeah, the alien, when the show says, oh yeah, the alien healing device exists, remember the alien healing device? You know what's going to happen. You know that Marcus is going to use it and die. and you have to wait for it to be shown to you. That's what kills me more than the actual image of Marcus hooked up to it saying, I love you. It is the wait and the knowledge that that's going to be the outcome here. That's the thing that really hits me in the gut. When it comes to the Marcus sacrifice and the reintroduction of the alien healing device, what has been the thing in all of that that has really hit you emotionally? What has brought those tears out?
Oh, it is the I love you. Usually, like, I start welling up as soon as he watches the logs, and I'm just like waiting for that moment of release when you finally see him with the machine. And I love the sort of tracking shot through the destruction that he's caused in Med Bay to the
device
and him and Ivanova.
That was a really great piece of visual storytelling to give us the journey of Marcus coming into the med bay, grabbing the device and plugging it all in without actually showing us Marcus doing that. It was a great piece of business. He does say, I love you, in his charming, charming British accent. I love you. And then he slowly...
A little stroke.
Are you going to miss him?
Yeah, I will. Like, I will feel his absence, definitely. But I also understand the choice of it, which is not something that I chose to accept in the first couple of rewatches. I'm like, why did you have to make him die? But now I'm like, I get why you make him die, but it makes me sad.
It does make it devastating that season 5 lacks both Ivanova and Marcus. We lose both of them. Obviously, there was no way to avoid that. Just weird behind-the-scenes stuff happened there, but I'll miss him very much. I really have grown attached to him on our watch through currently. I liked having a guy who was a quipster. Usually I hate that, but I liked him. They really found a groove with him, and I'm going to miss Franklin being buddied up with Marcus. That's what I'm going to miss the most, more than Ivanova and Marcus. I'm going to miss Franklin and Marcus. That was just a wonderful duo that they did take advantage of, but not enough. They needed to take more advantage of that, just because it's undeniable how well those two actors worked off of each other, and also the characters just naturally being opposites.
Sheridan is working towards accidentally achieving a promise that he didn't know that he's made, which is to free Mars!
Oh, he always intended to free Mars. Yes, he may have squashed the Mars riots last time, but...
Yeah, but now he's on a different side. He has a different agenda.
He's following through.
It's totally fine. It's totally fine.
He keeps his promises.
Even though Franklin promised it on his behalf without talking to him about it. But they... fuck up Mars. They fuck up the fleet. And they just keep on going.
Well, they being specifically Sheridan sent who?
Sheridan's a mother. but so he's like, we can't fight on two fronts. That doesn't work out.
Listen up, Lord Reefer. I know you're dead. But two fronts, that's crazy. 12, that's insane.
Yep. We learned that lesson from America in the 20th century. Imagine if he name dropped.
Imagine if he name
dropped. The Iraq War.
Imagine if he named, what, the first one?
Oh, yeah, this came out before the second one, but he's set
after that. I would like it if he did keep predicting real world events that happened after the show was made.
Yes. But
this reminds me of when Australia brought in that Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. He came in and he said, my name's Albo, call me by that. I want to be called Sherido when I become president.
Oh, side note.
I want to be called Jono.
Side note. I was chatting with a year 9 student and they were like, I don't know anything. Like,
yeah, you're in year 9, you don't know anything.
Oh, is it?
I don't know anything, miss. You're right. You're in year 9. You're stupid. And that's why these kids suck. They're just too stupid.
I was like, oh, surely you know something. Like, you know who our prime minister is, right? And she was like, no. And I was like, Anthony Albanese? Does that name sound familiar? And she was just like, no. And then I was like, Albo? And she was like, oh, that guy.
He's our prime minister. He goes to music concerts because he's down with it. He's a cool guy.
With that, let's return to the show.
Well, Garibaldi, Lita, Franklin, yes. they're on Mars.
Without Lita, they would have lost this war. Because,
and I'm sure Sheridan will be real thankful that for that in season 5 and help her out.
Show his appreciation and respect for her and for
telepaths?
The race of telepaths.
Yeah, because he used them as weapons.
Homo superior.
He used them as
cycle.
Use these innocent people as weapons.
But
yeah.
It was the hardest decision he's ever made.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
He picked ones without families.
He seems so broken up about it.
Nobody would mourn the loss. So that would make it better, right?
Because they're losers. Oh, I'm sure Sheridan's crying about it after this.
If you have 6 children in captivity that you bred for captivity and then you murdered all of them, it's better than if you kidnapped 6 kids and murdered them, right?
I don't know, I'm in year 9. So, I don't know anything, miss. I like this side of the story too because it was playful. They're playful. Garibaldi is cracking jokes.
Yeah,
Franklin is the most serious
playing
one.
Playing around in a bunker.
I like the little piss poor fight scene that they had in the bunker because they're rugged up.
The propaganda posters.
Oh, to see them again. I like that they're all rugged up in their cult, like, you know, their nice sci-fi, let's keep warm outfits with the big fluffy hoods and they just punch a bunch of people, but really slowly because these outfits
I
are so huge.
The fluffy hoods.
Those fluffy coats look comfortable, and they had to secure Mars and send in these coordinates so that Marcus and the White Star can fly in and destroy all of these bases and stop Earth being able to send more stuff out there and secure Mars and help free it. And even though this doesn't take up too much time, I enjoyed just seeing Garibaldi again. Just being the smart Alec man he is. The whole bit about longitude and latitude, I had a good chuckle at that. It's funny because we gain Garibaldi again as the character that brings levity to the series and lose Marcus in the same episode.
Well, I assume that you worked out that whole longitude-latitude thing. I know you get confused sometimes.
You're right. I keep mixing them up. I got it right. I think I got it right. Okay, fine. Which goes vertically, longitude or latitude?
What did you think about Franklin, though? Because he is talking, he gives the exposition about how they are using the telepaths. He's giving us a bit of a reminder in case we miss those episodes about the cryo-frozen telepaths. But
I really liked it. And something that I appreciated even more on this watch was the interplay between the direction of the camera and the music. Like, the synergy between those two aspects of the show was impeccable for me on this watch. Like, it just beat by beat landed really well and elevated the dialogue, and not in a way that overtook. It was just a moment where everything was working together to create this really pivotal moment of stopping and pulling all of these things together and holding your attention hostage while he explains it, knowing that there's so much action happening everywhere else, but you're captivated by Franklin as he explains what they're doing, and you feel it weigh on him.
Because of course it does. He is saying why they are doing this. He is saying that. And this person is arguing with him and countering him and basically being him. The person who would say, this is horrible. You can't do this. You're a doctor. You're supposed to save lives, not kill them and take them away and mutilate them and use them and abuse them like this. You're a doctor. You're supposed to help. And she is serving this function as being the voice that Franklin has had in his head about this entire thing, because we have seen throughout the episodes leading to this, it gnaw away at him that this is what he has chosen to do, because it has to be done. And when he's explaining it all and explaining to her why this has to be, I liked Biggs's performance where he has Franklin performing it as if he believes it. And then after a certain point, he can't keep up that pretense anymore. And that is just something he has to keep reciting to himself to make it okay.
It's a mantra, almost, of like, if I keep on saying it, it will become true. I will whisper my secrets into the universe.
And it's good to have that moment and that beat for Franklin, because he is a character that is so staunch in his convictions and his morals. But over time, especially since his walkabout, he's had to accept being more tolerant.
He's not the same doctor that he was in Believers.
No, he is not.
He's not the same person, but specifically, he's not the same doctor.
And now he is more willing to wrestle with the things that he just flipped off previously, like in the Minbari War. Here is a war that is very important, and I have to use my expertise as a doctor to help one side win over the other, and to do that, lives are going to be lost.
I will not walk away from this problem. It's hard. I have to do a wrong thing for the right reasons, and I have to struggle with that, but know that the bigger picture is important. And I think a really key part of that for me is always the way that he says a particular line, the way that he delivers the line about if we don't, like, the resources to help them are back on Earth, so if we don't get there, they're dead anyway. And that idea of they can't, like, they need this. The rest of the ones that were left behind are needed just as much. Like, they need this. So it's another justification of, It's not just so that we can succeed in getting to Earth, but so that we can save these other people.
They pop open those cryo-frozen telepaths and they've planted them on the enemy destroyers so that when they wake up, they will wander over and merge with the ships and disable them for a moment. And Leeta is needed to help activate them, to help wake them up using her enhanced telepathic abilities, as well as a device that Franklin has helped to make in the meantime, I guess.
He had a little sort of Hugh moment.
Oh, Hugh from Star Trek Discovery, where he made this awesome piece of technology off screen.
Yeah.
At least they didn't say that. He just grabbed it and put it on her head.
Yep.
And I just assume he made it. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it's always been here. I'm sure some nerd will write me and say, Ryan, this was referenced in episode 8 of season 4.
In the novels.
Oh, in that short story you don't like about Marcus. Marcus actually says, I helped my friend Franklin make this weird little crown for my friend Leeta, somebody I've never really talked to, if ever. Have Leeta and Marcus ever exchanged dialogue together? I don't know. Maybe. I don't think so. No. No? That's another question to be answered, nerds. They open up those telepaths. Leeta is there on Mars using her enhanced telepathic abilities with this random device that Franklin has built off screen. And her eyes go black because they just can't help but keep putting Patricia Tolman through those contact lenses and making her suffer while wearing them. That's something she really, really comments on a lot.
Yeah.
I thought it was good for the one and done thing, but then they kept bringing those black contact lenses back. Almost like to mess with her, I guess. It's kind of funny. She's cool when she wears them.
Yeah, it is. It is really fucking cool, and it works really well when they do use it. But I can imagine that being a nightmare.
It's a clever solution to the.
It's a good shortcut,
and it's a good payoff to the telepaths.
Yeah, yeah. It does have, like, I have mixed feelings about it because I do like them bringing up the telepaths and them using them as a weapon because that was what they were made to do, but they're doing it in a different way. But also, like, It is the show having to fast forward through a problem.
I don't know. I think it is.
Or do you think this was always going to be the plan?
I think that was probably always there. It's Clark also getting screwed over by one of his own little evil schemes of, let's hand over some telepaths to our shadow friends because they asked for them. And now here these telepaths are to come back and fuck up your little fascist government for you. And I think that's really funny.
Yeah, like it's a little taste of his own medicine sort of thing.
But the telepaths were made to be weapons. Yeah. That's why the Vorlons introduced the gene, and here they are being used and being thrown away by our hero, by Sheridan. And we don't see this weigh on him. We get told it does by Franklin, but Franklin's talking about himself.
Yes.
Let's be real.
Yeah.
Sheridan isn't sweating it because he has that soldier mentality.
He made the decision. He weighed up the cost. He's not going to regret it.
He doesn't have time.
Deal with it because he's dealing with the next problem. He's not going to deal with the ones behind him.
He talked about this in Gropos with General Franklin about if he feels like a murderer. And he talked about the soldier's mentality and the process you have to go through as an officer when you're making command level decisions as well. And it just feeds into that here. It's good to think about how this is going to be a very important thing in the divide between Sheridan and the telepaths going forward, that he was willing to use them in this way. These truly helpless people. and how even after the dust has settled, he doesn't, in my recollections of season 5, really feel the weight of what he has done here, but the telepaths do.
Hey, Doc. Had to be done.
Yeah.
And it should work. Assuming that Lita can hold it together.
Sheridan is plowing his way through the system right to Earth, but hey.
Disabling most of the Earth ships.
But Earth had a little trick, didn't they? They had a little trick. They had an ace up their sleeve here, which
Clark
is
Clark had a last ditch.
Real last ditch effort here.
Last ditch. Fuck you guys. If I'm going down, I'm taking all of you with me.
Oh, you're talking about that. I was going to talk about that. The last ditch effort was, let's get Sheridan's mentor, who we've never heard about before, to be the guy that will fight against him because he knows how he thinks.
I wanted to ignore that because I don't like it. I don't like the way that he turns to Sheridan's side.
Well, he's still a patriot.
At the end, but and it's just like, well, were you performing or at the beginning or...
No. He still says it at the end, yeah. Like, you're going to have to face Charles for this, but he isn't insane.
No.
To let Clark destroy the North American continent and the Eastern Seaboard?
Yeah. Like,
Clark,
but it's also like he doesn't attack Sheridan.
No, because there's no point. He.
But if he was like, it's that thing of he's loyal to Earth and in the old guard, and you've watched Sheridan grapple with that of taking up arms against his own government. And putting it back and being like, oh, we can't do it now, we're not ready. Or, oh no, they've got us in this position. Oh no, they're doing this, we can't do it now.
Real question for you.
Yeah?
Why is this not the Agamemnon? Why is this some random guy that we've never... Yeah, no. But why isn't this...
It would
this...
be much more powerful if it was and it was the
They don't need
same
to
crew.
Backfill everything either if it was the Agamemnon. We already know the history he has with it. We already know that the crew knows him so well, and it would just be an extra salt in the wound of Sheridan and make it feel hard to take back Earth if he has to fight against his own ship, but then
the turn
of redemption of them then saving Earth and realizing Sheridan's ways were better,
yeah.
It would be far better to me. But I always think that this is a case of the dramatic thing would be have Sheridan take back Earth on his old ship, and I think that's more important for JMS and many other people, but to me,
Vonnegut's dying wish.
To me, Left Court is just such a dip of an addition to the story. It's not even a bad idea, but
it's not enough.
He needed
and
to be there
it's
earlier.
Too much.
Yeah, he needed to be introduced earlier in the show for this as the last hurdle to go over. It's really boring. It's really boring to me.
Mackie was actually a turncoat.
Oh, if this was Mackie.
Yeah, like if it was Mackie was actually the leak from the couple of episodes ago and defected and got put in charge of the ship. Like if they threaded the needle with those things a little bit more, it would be much more satisfying.
The problem,
I'm like, I don't give a fucking shit about you, dude.
The problem is this: every time we cut over to Earth Force via Left Court, it is scenes of them saying Sheridan must have some awesome ace in the hole plan.
Isn't Sheridan amazing?
He's an outside of the box thinker.
I admire him for this. He's on the wrong side.
We as the viewer already know this. Yeah. We gather this from the episode's existence. And
We know Sheridan.
I find it corny. That's the element of the episode that I think holds me back the most. Is
it's just disappointing.
This is what they have. Earth. Like,
you have so much, and this is.
I get the sweet little notion of here's a guy. He even has a bit of an inner life and conflict, like how Major Ryan did back in Severed Dreams about fighting your own people. Also. Would have been nice if Major Ryan ever came back. That would have been neat too. Probably couldn't get Bruce McGill again. But this here is... there's something to it, but most of the scenes boil down to this poor actor who... We'll do him for the spotlight, but I'm just going to say... The material didn't help him here.
No.
He's better in the beginning movie, I'll give him that. But... He has to just stand there talking very awkwardly about how brilliant Sheridan is to then be proven that Sheridan is indeed brilliant. And this guy gets to save the day. And I don't care.
No.
This is what Earth has as their last defense. Oh, his old mentor? I don't know.
That's the ace up their sleeve?
I guess. Okay.
That's the last stop to pull out. Fine.
No, Rachel. The last stop is the self-defense grid. And it shoots missiles and fires lasers. And it is a last ditch thing. That's what I actually like. I like that in the episode. That
Scorched Earth.
Before Scorched Earth, I like that the war ends. Or is about to end on a really pitiful note, that all of these forces have gathered together around Earth, and Earth, Clark, is so pig-headed that he will still fight to the very end of just turn the defense grid on and shoot him. What's the point? They're going to rip through it like tissue paper. They're just going to rip right through it.
You can't win my money if I... burn my money.
And so he does Scorched Earth, which is a Doctor Strangelove reference, the way they do it with the circles around the letters, and it reminds me of General Ripper. And he turns the defense grid against Earth, and so he will destroy the Earth itself because he's that insane and that pathetic.
Yep. And that corrupted.
Oh, but Rachel, what type of coward is he?
A suicidal one?
He's so much of a coward that he would kill himself rather than be taken.
And kill everybody else. Like,
yeah.
If I'm going down, I'm taking all of you bastards with me.
An absolute worm. Great way to end him. That
makes perfect sense.
That's the part of the end of this conflict I love, which is Clark being such a fucking whack job that he would be that pathetic.
And he waits until the very last second. He waits when he knows that he is cornered with no escape.
Captain, I believe he's turned the defense grid toward Earth. We can't override the systems here. If you don't stop them, they'll fire in 10 minutes.
ISN is back. ISN is back in the hands of genuine reporters, not Clark's people for propaganda.
They brought her back.
Jane is back. ISN Jane is here. And I believed she was devastated and overwhelmed and overjoyed at being back.
This is the stuff of Babylon 5. I come for it. They are so
loving of these minor players in the story.
Everybody in the world matters.
The fact that this is the reporter we use, the news anchor we used to see all of the time. All of the time! When they took her away in season 3, it was very dramatic. It was very scary and very, 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 very in line with what Earth was becoming, that they would take out the news and do it in the most obvious of ways and then backpedal it and give us the new news that
this
said
that
was...
This isn't a hostile takeover!
To then, a while later, as she says, it's been over a year, or it's been about a year, here she is again, it's the same actress, and she's there, and us, the viewers, missed her.
Yep.
We're happy to see her again, and we're really disturbed by the fact that she's clearly been tortured and interrogated and brutalized in all of this time with how this actress portrays it. The shakiness in her line deliveries, the amount of emotions that are just brimming to the surface, as you said, while still trying to present the news. And it's the type of thing that Babylon 5 does. The war is won. We did it. Hooray. Cut to the news, and here are the consequences of that, both good and bad, because
the reality of that.
The reality. Here is a person, thanks to Sheridan, who is now freed, but she still has to report the news, and the news even talks about how there will be things that have to be done now because of this. It is not over because the bad guy shot himself in the head and the good guy saved the planet from being burned to the ground. We still have many, many things to go through because winning a war isn't that simple. There's a whole bunch of hoopla you have to go through.
I really do appreciate that it does take that time to set up that conflict that will be ongoing. That's not something that goes away. Like, it's not just for the rest of the season and then, oh, yep, everything's sorted. He's president. It's over. It's over. Nobody questions it anymore. We're done.
Earth
We're
is done. No longer shitty now. It's good and nice.
And it will never be shitty again.
Never, ever.
Never, ever, ever. But it's fascinating that it wants to do that. Like, that's what it cares about as a show, almost. But you know who I don't care about?
Who?
The character that is the focus of this week's Spotlight.
Spotlight is the part of the show where we talk about an actor or actress that appeared in a given episode. We go over their role in the show, their performance, things we've seen them in, and any interesting pieces of trivia. And Rachel, who are you hinting at? It's not Marcus, is it?
No.
This is his last episode. We could talk about Jason Carter.
I would have preferred to talk about him. No, we're talking about J. Patrick McCormack.
Who plays?
General?
Mm-hmm.
Left...
Do you even know his name? It's General Leftcourt. We've said it like 15 times in this discussion.
No, like, I had it in my head. But for some reason, my brain misfired and wanted me to say Leftcourt. And I'm like, that's not right.
That is right. Leftcourt.
No. I misspoke. Sorry. My brain misfired and said Night Court.
No, we already had Bull from Night Court.
I know. And I'm like, Left Court, Night Court, what is my brain doing? And I just froze.
You're not a fan of Left Court?
No. Are you?
No.
I don't like the pomposity of when he like takes over and explains why he's there, and I don't get his heel turn. Like, I get the way that you explained it with like just like, oh no, he's going against Earth. But then it's just like, well, if you can accept that and go against the chain of command when it comes to supporting that action, how are you still okay with Clark after the firing on civilians thing happened? Like, yeah, don't take arms against your government, but what happened? Like, I don't see enough of a difference between those two things to believe in the turn, other than, oh, it's convenient, and, oh, well, Clark's lost, clearly, so...
They actually do have a follow-through on this, which is Lockley in season 5. She gets to be the stand-in for this complaint you're having of how does an Earth Force officer, especially one that's high ranking and has morals, how do they justify having served on that side and defended those actions and or carried them out? And Lockley gets to be that for season 5, and she goes through it very succinctly.
They do grapple with it.
But not here.
No, and Lefcourt is just one, done, gone. And each time I watch him and I watch the performance, I'm like always, I'm looking for a tell that he's lying in some way and being disingenuous when he's talking to them, because he's got that air about him. And then when he's talking about helping out Sheridan, he has a warmth that he didn't have before. And there's a lot of decisions in terms of the performer that's trying to bring out these notes that are not there in the script.
He's trying to play it as conflicted, as somebody who admires the man and even taught the man that he has to take down, but he has to because it's his job and you can't break the chain of command in this way, and it's illegal. It's a legal action you're doing.
You don't get to choose what's right and wrong when you're a soldier.
But he can't help but admire Sheridan's tenacity. Yeah. I do not like Lefcourt as a character. I don't like this performance. And I think it's a part of the direction. He's directed in a way that reminds me of season 1. And I'm pretty sure that John Copeland, who's a producer...
Yeah.
Directed this episode. This is his first ever directed episode, and I think it shows it in that shows. Way. He does this thing that they used a lot in season 1, which is characters talking, and Babylon 5 does use this a lot, but in season 1 it was far more prevalent, which is characters dramatically talking to one another while not facing one another. And this poor Lefcourt is doing that all the time, and it's corny, it's cheesy, it's very soap opera-y to me. And I don't know, as an actor he decided this, or the director decided this, but he comes across very much to me like a 1940s serial character.
Like,
he's a military guy from 1942, and he's going over these heady ideas, and he has that delivery where he...
Yeah.
And I just don't think it matches with the type of tone that the rest of the episode is going for. That's why Richard Gant as Mackie was so good, because he had a very obtuse nature as a character, but I think Gant caught the tone just right. I don't think the actor... is being in the right wavelength for what everyone else is doing and the episode in general. And so I walk away from this not being a fan. Now, he will reappear in the beginning, and I remember liking him in the beginning, the film In the Beginning. I remember liking that performance and his character there. So I'm very excited to see it again, to see if that still holds true, especially after being very lukewarm on it here.
I'm really glad that you brought up that point about the direction, because it was in Lefkowitz's scenes where I felt a distinct dissonance between the direction and the cinematography. Which I was like, why is this, doesn't feel like it's gelling. Feels like the cinematography is leagues above the direction. And you saying it was his first episode, I'm like, that's why. And he's a producer, so maybe he didn't listen.
He does direct more episodes, and he's got good episodes. So
yeah, like,
and this is a good episode. This is, I think, one of the highest rated episodes of the show and of this season.
And you get why. Like,
this is an expositionary character. Like, he has to stand there and say blatant things. And we have
he's talking at the audience.
We saw it for two seasons, Babylon 5. On a visual level, struggle to make those scenes work.
Yes.
And so now we are using somebody who is not one of those people who have figured it out. And so it feels like a throwback in a weird way of the simpler days.
I taught him everything he knows. I know how he thinks. I know how he fights. And to tell you the truth, I've always admired him. And now I'm going to have to kill him. And his ship. And everyone around him. It's a terrible day, Charlie. I wish to hell I'd never lived to see it.
He has been in a ton of things. I have seen him in a lot. And I was truly surprised.
Speaking of shitty Star Trek movies, he was in Nemesis.
He was in Nemesis, and I'm so sorry. To anyone who is a Nemesis, especially Tom Hardy. I'm so sorry, Tom Hardy, that you had to be in that movie and it actively ruined your life.
Yeah.
I was just going to state that I found it very surprising that he started his career in the late 80s, early 90s for film and television. It really isn't that long before this episode. And he's somebody that I've just seen in so much, and he looks older because he has the white hair here, and he has a certain look about him that you would imagine, oh, this guy's career spans back to, like with many of these people, to the 70s or 60s or early 80s, but no, it's relatively fresh in film and TV when it comes to, comparatively to this episode, but I've seen him in everything. He's been around.
Yeah.
Now for you, what are things that you have seen him in, if anything at all?
Well, let's start with Space Above and Beyond.
He was in the last episode.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most recent things that I've seen him in. Like, I've watched it recently, and I thought he was good in that. He was fun. He was also, like, a general or
corporate
general
sleaze
type. Yeah, like, a leader figure who's a slimy motherfucker. And he did it well. another thing that we watched recently that he was in is Catch Me If You Can.
He was in that as an auctioneer. And I remember seeing, he's that actor guy where, oh, that's the guy from B5 or from Star Trek, because he does have a very recognizable look. I don't know what type exactly, but he reminds me of a dog, like a bulldog or some kind of stoic dog type. And he just has jowls and a very defined jawline and chin, and that haircut and that color in his hair that he has that I've often seen. And he has that noble-sounding voice, the voice of authority, because in his career, he has played many authority figures. captains, admirals, generals, judges, on and on it goes, cops. And so when I look over his career and just talking about the recent things that, we have watched or even played, yeah. I mean, he was in L.A. Noir as a character.
You've played. He's in Boston Legal.
As a judge.
That we've watched.
He was in a really good episode of Boston Legal when Denny and Alan go on a fishing trip holiday together. Really good episode. And I remember him in it.
Yeah. And another thing that we watched not too long ago, Zodiac.
Yep, he was in Zodiac and he was in Mad Men around the same time. Now, I like that he has a pretty versatile range in Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he's played admirals, of course, but he's in one of the best Voyager episodes they ever did, which is Counterpoint. Which is an episode where the Voyager has been taken over by this totalitarian fascist alien race who are afraid of telepathic beings. So the telepathic characters have to be hidden away. So Tuvok's hidden away as they navigate the Voyager through this sector. And Janeway starts to form a complicated and romantic entanglement with the head alien guy. This actor was that guy's right-hand man.
Yeah.
And he was a piece of shit. He was a real nasty piece of work in that episode. And I saw a picture of him, and this is a testament to performance. Now, I didn't like Left Court, but I saw a picture of that character from Voyager, and I had a guttural reaction. I saw the picture and went, ugh. Because that's what the character made me feel.
I went, you fucker.
Because that episode had great antagonists.
Yeah.
Because you liked, in a weird way, you liked but also hated that main guy that she's interacting with. But the rest of them are assholes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
They're all awful. He has been in a bunch of sitcoms that we're both familiar with over the years. Your classics, Married with Children.
Oh, yeah.
Seinfeld.
Yep. Married with Children was one of his first, one of his early works. He was in a film I know you love, National Lampoon's Van Wilder. Ryan Reynolds.
No. He was also in Ellen and Third Rock from the Sun.
And Paul Verhoeven's Hollow Man, a movie that made him quit Hollywood forever and never turn back.
The Drew Carey Show.
NYPD Blue. He was not there when Andrea Thompson was there, sadly.
No, a different kind of television show. He was in Seventh Heaven.
You do love Seventh Heaven.
I do not. And The X-Files.
He was in the dogged years of The X-Files, so my memory's a little hazy.
No,
the only dogged episode I remember is the Brady Bunch episode, which is a great one.
He was also in Ally McBeal.
Now, do you have any pieces of trivia or information about the man himself?
No, I couldn't find anything interesting when I had a little dig.
He's an enigma. I actually did a good amount of digging into him, and he is actually hard to pin down any information. And I don't know why. For this series, they've got all of these character actors, all of these TV people, people who were character actors at the time or would go on to be that. And when you have these people that do these one-and-done roles or these smaller roles frequently, like this guy has done, you do find relatively easily information about them.
Somebody's gone, oh, I want to know about that guy that keeps on appearing as, oh, it's that guy.
If I can know more about Jinxo than an actor like this who has had the career double the amount, I'm truly surprised. I can't find anything on him. I would love to know his story. I would love to know his views on acting, how he got into it, what the type of roles he plays, like likes to play, and more. I have always enjoyed him as a performer. All of these things we've listed off, I remember him in them, and he does a good job. He's a reliable actor when you call upon him to play the authority man. And he can be funny, too. And I know we've been bagging on him in this episode, but it's just a case where he was a little too corny for us here. But I am surprised. You did a bit of digging. I did a lot more digging, and I couldn't come up with
when
much.
When I searched for him, it just came up with obituaries for other Patrick McCormacks.
Sorry for the delay, Captain, but we had some trouble on Mars. You might have heard something about it.
Well, my apologies, General. We're only doing our jobs.
And though you'll have to stand before a board of inquiry on this one, Sheridan, still... Welcome home, John.
What would you rate Endgame on our scale of yum being bad and yum yum being good?
I want you to go first.
I like this episode when I'm watching it more than thinking about it afterwards. And that's an important piece of entertainment in itself.
Yeah.
There's many episodes of shows that you love it when you're watching it. But once you step away from it, you don't give it as much attention as that viewing of it. And that's how I feel about Endgame, where if I was watching it, I would say to you, oh, this is a yum yum. But I'm not watching it right now. And I'm left feeling a bit middle of the road on it. I give this a yum.
Yum.
I know, heresy from a Babylon 5 fan not to love Endgame, but it's not one of my favorites. I prefer a lot of the other Earth conflict episodes.
Like, it's not a banger of an episode. It's strong, and it is... It does all of the right things in the right places for the most part, but it just doesn't stick the landing. It doesn't feel like it's more than the sum of its parts. And I needed to make you go first so that I felt more comfortable giving this one a yum.
Yum.
Are you keen to know what we'll be watching and talking about next time?
On the next Babylon 5.
Episode 21, Rising Star. The war is won. Now it's time to win the peace. Earth makes concessions. A new alliance springs from the League of Non-Aligned Worlds. Mars is declared free and Sheridan is selected for a new leadership post. Ooh, Rising Star. Ooh, I am excited to give that episode a watch because that one is wild. That's how I always think of Rising Star, as a really wild episode. One is JMS swinging for the fences in a lot of directions.
It's a breakneck pace in a weird way.
And it has a Polish actress in it, and as somebody with some Polish heritage, I'm excited to see her and say, hey, I know that accent isn't Russian, it's Polish.
Yeah.
But we'll be talking about that next time on the podcast.
Next week on Yum Yum 5, you'll get to hear our discussion about that. But if you cannot wait, any longer for more yum yum pot in your life, well, have you signed up to the Patreon? Because if you haven't, there's like 6 bucket loads of content over there for you. Like, we've got all of the Star Trek movie discussions, all of the X-Men, all of the Alien movies. We've got our discussions, the best and worst rated episodes of Star Trek.
Currently, we are going through
the Expanse is our current show that we are working our way through. We're, you know, in the grips of it. We've finished off season one. We're getting into season two. It's exciting. And it's interesting because we are both watching that for the first time, which is the first time that we've done that particular approach.
So people can come over and listen to all of that content and get to be a part of a group Discord where you can talk to some fellow yumlings. We are also on all of those social medias under Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. Feel free to follow us and subscribe to us and go through all of the posts that we have on there and interact. If you want to email us, what is that email address?
yumyumpod@gmail.com, of course.
Of course it is. If you want to drop us a line and let us know something, if you want to drop us a piece of knowledge, head on over to that email. All of this is in the description of the episode, so it's all there. We gave you everything you needed. And if you have not rated and reviewed the podcast, it would be awesome if you did that. Share us around with all of your friends, family, and enemies so that more people can get the yum-yum in their tum-tum. Jakar is a character that is featured in this television series called Babylon 5, and I looked all over for him in Endgame. I didn't see him. Did you see him? Was he hiding in the background there?
No!
Was he on a non-heavy cruiser eating Swedish meatballs?
No, Jakar. No, Jakar.
So he wasn't here to say the iconic greeting / farewell. Was it? Could you use it as a greeting? Is it one of those where it could go both ways? Because he smacks his chest and says, good eating to you. Is that something where you could have that as just a farewell? I feel like I could use it for both.
Yeah.
Is this an aloha situation?
I get you, your meaning. I get your meaning, but I feel like... I feel like I would feel more comfortable hearing it as like a grace situation of like before a meal.
Oh, of course. It makes sense there.
A greeting.
That's why JMS stopped using it, because it made no sense. It's just a weird sci-fi mumbo jumbo he came up with because Jakar's an alien.
You going to dinner with Sinclair, I think?
It was remember. Takashima he said it to. Remember Takashima and her flute? No, clarinet? No, no, recorder.
No, I didn't.
Here's a question to end this on, a real question. Since we always make fun of the good eating to you, because it is an absurd thing, do you have a preference for, in your science fiction, aliens to have those kind of kooky, culturally different idioms and language things in your science fiction shows?
Yeah, I enjoy those little bits of cultural differences.
Like,
they're usually pretty cringy, but I like the idea.
That's it. I like it on paper as an idea, but oftentimes it's goofy stuff like, good eating to you!